The 33 sermons on Nibbana were delivered by the Venerable Bhikkhu Katukurunde Nyanananda in Sinhala at Mitrigala Nisaranavanaya Forest Hermitage. They were translated into English by the same Venerable Monk, presently residing at Potkulkala Forest Hermitage in Kandagedra Devalagam.
Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse. Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse. Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse. Etam santam etam panitam yadidam sabba sankhara samatho sabbo padhipakini sarbo. Sannakhyo virago nirodho nibbana. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely, the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, recently, we have had an occasion to listen to a series of sermons on Nibbana, and there have been differences of opinion regarding the interpretation of some deep suttas on Nibbana in those sermons. And so, the Venerable Great Preceptor suggested to me that it would be useful to this group if I would give a set of sermons on Nibbana touching on those controversial points. At first, for many reasons, I hesitated to accept this invitation for a serious task. But then, as the Venerable Great Preceptor repeatedly encouraged me on this, I gave some thought as to how best I could set about doing it. And it occurred to me that it would be best if I could address these sermons directly to the task before us in this Nisaranavanaya, and that is meditative attention, rather than dealing with those deep controversial suttas in academic isolation. And that is why I have selected the above quotation as the theme for the entire set of sermons, hoping that it would help create the correct atmosphere of meditative attention. Etam santam etam panitam yadidam sabba sankhara samatho sabbo upadhipati nissaggo tannakkhayo virago nirodho nibbana. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely, the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. This, in fact, is a meditation subject in itself, a kammatthana. This is the reflection on the peace of Nibbana, upasamanusati. So, if we can successfully make use of this as both the heading and the theme of these sermons, we would be in a position to understand those six qualities of the Dhamma. We are told that the Dhamma is Svakhata, that it is well proclaimed, Sandhittika, can be seen here and now, Akalika, timeless, Ehipassika, inviting one to come and see, Opanayika, leading one onwards, Pachyattang Vedhitabbo Vinyohi, that it can be understood by the wise, each one by himself. This set of sermons would have fulfilled its purpose if it drives home the true significance of these six qualities of the Dhamma. Now, at the very outset, I would like to say a few things by way of preparing the background, and I do hope that this assembly would bear with me for saying certain things that I will be compelled to say in this concern. By way of background, something has to be said as to why there are so many complications with regard to the meaning of some of the deep suttas on Nibbana. There is a popular belief that the commentaries are finally traceable to a miscellany of the Buddha word scattered here and there as Pakinnaka Desana. But the true state of affairs seems to be rather different. Very often, the commentaries are unable to say something conclusive regarding the meaning of deep suttas. So they simply give some possible interpretations and the reader finds himself at a loss to choose the correct one. Sometimes the commentaries go at a tangent and miss the correct interpretation. Why the commentaries are silent on some deep suttas is also a problem to modern day scholars. There are some historical reasons leading to this state of affairs in the commentaries. In the Ani Sutta of the Nidanavagga in the Samyutta Nikaya, we find the Buddha making certain prophetic utterances regarding the dangers that will befall the Sasana in the future. It is said that in times to come, monks will lose interest in those deep suttas which deal with matters transcendental, that they would not listen to those suttas that have to do with the idea of emptiness, sunyata. They would not think it even worthwhile learning or pondering over the meanings of those suttas. Yete suttanta tathagata bhasita gambhira gambhiratha lokuttara sunyata patisanyutta. Tesu bhanyamanesu na sususi santi na sotang odahissanti na anya cittang upatthapissanti na te dhamme ugahitabbang pariyapunitabbang manyasanti. There is also another historical reason that can be adduced. An idea got deeply rooted at a certain stage in the Sasana history, that what is contained in the Sutta Pitaka is simply the conventional teaching, and so it came to imply that there is nothing so deep in these suttas. This notion also had its share in the present lack of interest in these suttas. According to Manoratha Purani, the Anguttara commentary, already at an early stage in the Sasana history of Sri Lanka, there had been a debate between those who upheld the precept and those who stood for realization. And it is said that those who upheld the precept won the day. The final conclusion was that for the continuity of the Sasana, precept itself is enough, not so much the realization. Of course, the efforts of the reciter monks of old for the preservation of the precept in the midst of droughts and famines and other calamitous situations are certainly praiseworthy. But the unfortunate thing about it was this. The basket of the Buddha word came to be passed on from hand to hand in the dark, so much so that there was the risk of some valuable things slipping out in the process. Also, there have been certain semantic developments in the commentarial period, and this will be obvious to anyone searching for the genuine Dhamma. It seems that there had been a tendency in the commentarial period to elaborate even on some lucid words in the suttas simply as a commentarial requirement, and this led to the inclusion of many complicated ideas. By too much overdrawing in the commentaries, the deeper meanings of the Dhamma got obscured. As a matter of fact, the depth of the Dhamma has to be seen through lucidity, just as much as one sees the bottom of a tank only when the water is lucid. Dve nama kim, namanche rupanche. What is the two? Name and form. This is the second out of the 10 questions Buddha had put to the Venerable Samanera Sopaka, who had attained arahantship at the age of 7. It is like asking a child, can you count up to 10? All the 10 questions were deep, the 10th being on arahantship. But of course, Venerable Sopaka gave the right answer each time. Now it is the second question and its answer that we are concerned with here. Namancha rupancha. In fact, this is a basic teaching in insight training. It is obvious that nama means name, and in the suttas also, nama when used by itself means name. However, when we come to the commentaries, we find some kind of hesitation to recognize this obvious meaning. Even in the present context, the commentary Paramattha Jyotika explains the word name so as to mean bending. It says that all immaterial states are called nama in the sense that they bend towards their respective objects, and also because the mind has the nature of inclination. Aramana abhimukhaṁ namanato cittasya ca nati hetuto sabbampi arūpaṁ nāmanti ujjati. And this is the standard definition of nama in Abhidhamma compendiums and commentaries. The idea of bending towards an object is brought in to explain the word nama. It may be that they thought it too simple an interpretation to explain nama with reference to name, particularly because it is a term that has to do it's deep inside. However, as far as the teachings in the suttas are concerned, nama still has a great depth, even when it is understood in the sense of name. Namang sabbang anvabhavi, nama bhiyo navijyati, namasya eka dhammasya sabbeva vasamanvagu. Name has conquered everything. There is nothing greater than name. All have gone under the sway of this one thing called name. Also, there is another verse of the same type, but unfortunately, its original meaning is often ignored by the present-day commentators. Akkheya sanyino satta, akkheyasmin patitthita, akkheyam aparinyaya, yoga mayanti machuno. Beings are conscious of what can be named. They are established on the nameable. By not comprehending the nameable things, they come under the yoke of death. All this shows that the word nama has a deep significance even when it is taken in the sense of name. But now let us see whether there is something wrong in rendering nama by name in the case of the term nama-rupa. To begin with, let us turn to the definition of nama-rupa as given by the Venerable Sariputta in the Sammāditthi Sutta of the Majjhima Nikāya. Vedana sanya chetana phasso manasikaro idam uccata uso namam chattarica mahabhutani chatunnanca mahabhutanam upadaya rupam idam uccata uso rupam iti idancha namam idancha rupam idam uccata uso namarupam. Feeling, perception, intention, contact, attention, this friend is called name. The four great primaries and form dependent on the four great primaries, this friend is called form. So this is name and this is form. This friend is called name and form. Well, this seems lucid enough as a definition, but let us see whether there is any justification for regarding feeling, perception, intention, contact and attention as name. Suppose there is a little child, a toddler, who is still unable to speak or understand language. Someone gives him a rubber ball and the child has seen it for the first time. If the child is told that it is a rubber ball, he might not understand it. How does he get to know that object? He smells it, feels it, and tries to eat it, and finally rolls it on the floor. At last he understands that it is a plaything. Now the child has recognized the rubber ball not by the name that the world has given it, but by those factors included under name in nama-rupa, namely feeling, perception, intention, contact and attention. This shows that the definition of nama in nama-rupa takes us back to the most fundamental notion of name, to something like its prototype. The world gives a name to an object for purposes of easy communication. When it gets the sanction of others, it becomes a convention. While commenting on the verse just quoted, the commentator also brings in a bright idea. As an illustration of the sweeping power of name, he points out that if any tree happens to have no name attached to it by the world, it would at least be known as the nameless tree. Now as for the child, even such a usage is not possible. So it gets to know an object by the aforesaid method. And the factors involved there are the most elementary constituents of name. Now, it is this elementary name and form world that a meditator also has to understand, however much he may be conversant with the conventional world. But if a meditator wants to understand this name and form world, he has to come back to the state of a child, at least from one point of view. Of course, in this case, the equanimity should be accompanied by knowledge and not by ignorance. And that is why a meditator makes use of mindfulness and full awareness, sati sampajanya, in his attempt to understand name and form. Even though he is able to recognize objects by their conventional names, for the purpose of comprehending name and form, a meditator makes use of those factors that are included under name, feeling, perception, intention, contact and attention. All these have a specific value to each individual, and that is why the Dhamma has to be understood each one by himself. Paccattang veditabbo. This Dhamma has to be realized by oneself. One has to understand one's own world of name and form by oneself. No one else can do it for him, nor can it be defined or denoted by technical terms. Now it is in this world of name and form that suffering is found. According to the Buddha, suffering is not out there in the conventional world of worldly philosophers. It is to be found in this very name and form world. So the ultimate aim of a meditator is to cut off the craving in this name and form. As it is said, Acchecche tannam idhanama rupe. Now if we are to bring in a simile to clarify this point, the Buddha is called the incomparable surgeon, Sallakatto Anuttaro. Also, he is sometimes called Tanha Sallasa Hantaram, one who removes the dart of craving. So the Buddha is the incomparable surgeon who pulls out the poison tipped arrow of craving. We may say, therefore, that according to the Dhamma, Nam Rupa or name and form is like the wound in which the arrow is embedded. When one is wounded by a poison-tipped arrow, the bandage has to be put not on the archer or on his bowstring, but on the wound itself. First of all, the wound has to be well located and cleaned up. Similarly, the comprehension of name and form is the preliminary step in the treatment of the wound caused by the poison-tipped arrow of craving. And it is for that purpose that a meditator has to pay special attention to those basic components of name: feeling, perception, intention, contact and attention, however much he may be proficient in words found in worldly usage. It may even appear as a process of unlearning down to childlike simplicity. But of course, the equanimity implied here is not based on ignorance but on knowledge. We find ourselves in a similar situation with regard to the significance of Rupa in Nama Rupa. Here too, we have something deep. But many take Nama Rupa to mean mind and matter. Like materialists, they think that there is a contrast between mind and matter. But according to the Dhamma, there is no such rigid distinction. It is a pair that is interrelated, and taken together, it forms an important link in the chain of Paticchasamuppada. Rupa exists in relation to name, and that is to say, that form is known with the help of name. As we saw above, the child got a first-hand knowledge of the rubber ball with the help of contact, feeling, perception, intention and attention. Now, in the definition of form as Chattaricha Mahabhutani, Chatunnancha Mahabhutanam Upadaya Rupam, the four great primaries are mentioned because they constitute the most primary notion of form, just as much as feeling, perception, intention, contact and attention represent the most primary notion of name, conventionally so called. Even so, the four great primaries form the basis for the primary notion of form as the world understands it. It is not an easy matter to recognize these primaries. They are evasive, like ghosts. But out of their interplay, we get the perception of form, rupa sanya. In fact, what is called rupa in this context is rupa sanya. It is with reference to the behavior of the four great elements that the world builds up its concept of form. Its perception, recognition and designation of form is in terms of their behavior. And that behavior can be known with the help of those members representing name. The earth element is recognized through the qualities of hardness and softness. The water element through the qualities of cohesiveness and dissolution. The fire element through hotness and coolness. And the wind element through motion and inflation. In this way, one gets acquainted with the nature of the four great primaries and the perception of form, rupa sanya, that one has at the back of one's mind is the net result of that acquaintance. So this is nama rupa. This is one's world. The relationship between rupa and rupa sanya will be clear from the following verse. Yattha namancha rupancha asesam uparujyati patigham rupa sanyacha itthe sa chidyate jata. This is a verse found in the Jata Sutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. In that sutta, we find a deity putting a riddle before the Buddha for solution. Anto jata bahi jata jataya jatita paja tang tang gotama pucchami ko imang vijataye jatam. There is a tangle within and a tangle without. The world is entangled with a tangle. About that, O Gotama, I ask you, who can disentangle this tangle? The Buddha answers the riddle in three verses, the first of which is fairly well known because it happens to be the opening verse of the Visuddhimagga. Sile patitthaya naro sapanyo cittang panyancha bhavyam atapi nipako bhikkhu so imam vijataye jatam. This means that a wise monk established in virtue, developing concentration and wisdom, being ardent and prudent, is able to disentangle this tangle. Now this is the second verse. Yesam ragocha dosocha avijjacha virajita kina sava arhanto tesam vijatita jata. In whom lust, hate and ignorance have faded away, those influx-free arhants, it is in them that the tangle is disentangled. It is the third verse that is relevant to our topic. Yattha namancha rupancha asesam uparujyati patigham rupasanyacha itthesa chidyate jata. Where name and form as well as resistance and the perception of form are completely cut off, it is there that the tangle gets snapped. The reference here is to Nibbana. It is there that the tangle is disentangled. The coupling of name and form with Patigha and Rupa Sanya in this context is significant. Here Patigha does not mean repugnance but resistance. It is the resistance which comes as a reaction to inert matter. For instance, when one knocks against something in passing, one turns back to recognize it. Sense reaction is something like that. The Buddha has said that the worldling is blind until at least the Dhamma eye arises in him. So the blind worldling recognizes an object by the very resistance he experiences in knocking against that object. Patigha and Rupa Sanya form a pair. Patigha is that experience of resistance which comes by the knocking against an object. And Rupa Sanya as perception of form is the resulting recognition of that object. The perception is in terms of what is hard, soft, hot or cool. Out of such perceptions common to the blind worldlings arises the conventional reality, the basis of which is the world. Knowledge and understanding are very often associated with words and concepts, so much so that if one knows the name of a thing, one is supposed to know it. Because of this misconception, the world is in a tangle. Names and concepts, particularly the nouns, perpetuate the ignorance in the world. Therefore, insight is the only path of release. And that is why a meditator practically comes down to the level of a child in order to understand name and form. He may even have to pretend to be a patient in slowing down his movements for the sake of developing mindfulness and full awareness. So we see that there is something really deep in nama rupa, even if we render it as name and form. There is an implicit connection with name as conventionally so called, but unfortunately this connection is ignored in the commentaries when they bring in the idea of bending to explain the word name. So we need not hesitate to render our rupa by name and form. Simple as it may appear, it goes deeper than the worldly concepts of name and form. Now if we are to summarize all what we have said in this connection, we may say, naming name and form is a formal name. It is an apparent name. Forming name and form is a nominal form. It is a form only in name. We have to make a similar comment on the meaning of the word Nibbana. Here too, one can see some unusual semantic developments in the commentarial period. It is very common these days to explain the etymology of the word Nibbana with the help of a phrase like Vana Sankhataya Tanhaya Nikkantatta. And that is to say that Nibbana is so called because it is an exit from craving, which is a form of weaving. To take the element Vana in the word to mean a form of weaving is as good as taking Nama in Namarupa as some kind of bending. It is said that craving is a kind of weaving in the sense that it connects up one form of existence with another, and the prefix ni is said to signify the exit from that weaving. But nowhere in the suttas do we get this sort of etymology and interpretation. On the other hand, it is obvious that the suttas use the word Nibbana in the sense of extinguishing or extinction. In fact, this is the sense that brings out the true essence of the Dhamma. For instance, the Ratana Sutta, which is so often chanted as a paritta, says that the arahants go out like a lamp. Nibbanti dhira yathayam padipo. Those wise ones get extinguished even like this lamp. The simile of a lamp getting extinguished is also found in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. Sometimes it is the figure of a torch going out. Pajyota seva nibbanam vimokho chetaso ahu. The mind's release was like the extinguishing of a torch. The simile of the extinction of a fire is very often brought in as an illustration of Nibbana. And in the Aggivacchagata Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, we find the Buddha presenting it as a sustained simile, giving it a deeper philosophical dimension. Now when a fire burns, it does so with the help of firewood. When a fire is burning, if someone were to ask, what is burning? What shall we say as a reply? Is it the wood that is burning or the fire that is burning? The truth of the matter is that the wood burns because of the fire and the fire burns because of the wood. So it seems we already have here a case of relatedness of this to that, idappachyata. This itself shows that there is a very deep significance in the fire simile. Nibbana as a term for the ultimate aim of this Dhamma is equally significant because of its allusion to the going out of a fire. In the Asankhata Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, as many as 33 terms are listed to denote this ultimate aim. But out of all these epithets, Nibbana became the most widely used, probably because of its significant allusion to the fire. The fire simile holds the answer to many questions relating to the ultimate goal. The wandering ascetic Vacchagotta, as well as many others, accused the Buddha of teaching a doctrine of annihilation. Sato sattasya uccedam vinasam vibhavam panyapeti. Their accusation was that the Buddha proclaims the annihilation, destruction and non-existence of a being that is existent. And the Buddha answered them fairly and squarely with the fire simile. Now if a fire is burning in front of you, dependent on grass and twigs as fuel, you would know that it is burning dependently and not independently, that there is no fire in the abstract. And when the fire goes out with the exhaustion of that fuel, you would know that it has gone out because the conditions for its existence are no more. As a sidelight to the depth of this argument, it may be mentioned that the Pali word upadana used in such context has the sense of both fuel as well as grasping. And in fact, fuel is something that the fire does for its burning. Upadana paccaya bhava, dependent on grasping its existence. These are two very important links in the doctrine of dependent arising, paticchasamuppada. The eternalists, overcome by the craving for existence, thought that there is some permanent essence in existence as a reality. But what had the Buddha to say about existence? He said that what is true for the fire is true for existence as well. That is to say, that existence is dependent on grasping. So long as there is a grasping, there is an existence. As we saw above, the firewood is called upadana because it catches fire. The fire catches hold of the wood, and the wood catches hold of the fire, and so we call it firewood. This is a case of a relation of this to that, idappacchetta. Now it is the same with what is called existence, which is not an absolute reality. Even in the Vedic period, there was a dilemma between being and non-being. They wondered whether being came out of non-being or non-being came out of being. Katham asatah sat jayate. How could being come out of non-being? In the face of this dilemma regarding the first beginnings, they were sometimes forced to conclude that there was neither non-being nor being at the start. Na satasit, no sadasit tadanim. Or else, in the confusion, they would sometimes leave the matter unsolved, saying that perhaps only the Creator knew about it. All this shows what a lot of confusion these two words, sat and asat, being and unbeing, had created for the philosophers. It was only the Buddha who presented the perfect solution after a complete reappraisal of the whole problem of existence. He pointed out that existence is a fire kept up by the fuel of grasping, so much so that when grasping ceases, existence ceases as well. In fact, the fire simile holds the answer to the tetralemma included among the 10 unexplained points very often found mentioned in the suttas. It concerns the state of the Tathagata after death, whether he exists, does not exist, both or neither. The presumption of the questioner is that one or the other of these four must be and could be answered in the affirmative. The Buddha solves or dissolves this presumptuous tetralemma by bringing in the fire simile. He points out that when a fire goes out with the exhaustion of the fuel, it is absurd to ask in which direction the fire has gone. All that one can say about it is that the fire has gone out. Nibbuto deva sankham gacchati. It comes to be reckoned as gone out. It is just a reckoning, an idiom, a worldly usage, which is not to be taken too literally. So this illustration through the fire simile drives home to the worldling the absurdity of his presumptuous tetralemma of the Tathagata. In the Upasiva Sutta of the Parayana Vagga of the Sutta Nipata, we find the lines, Acchi yathavata vegena khitto atthang paleti na upeti sankham. Like the flame thrown out by the force of the wind reaches its end, it cannot be reckoned. Here the reckoning is to be understood in terms of the four propositions of the tetralemma. Such reckonings are based on a total misconception of the phenomenon of fire. It seems that the deeper connotations of the word Nibbana in the context of Paticchasamuppada were not fully appreciated by the commentators, and that is why they went in search of a new etymology. They were too shy of the implications of the word extinction. Probably, to avoid the charge of nihilism, they felt compelled to reinterpret certain key passages on Nibbana. They conceived Nibbana as something existing out there in its own right. They would not say where, but sometimes they would even say that it is everywhere. With an undue grammatical emphasis, they would say that it is on coming to that Nibbana that lust and other defilements are abandoned. නිබ්බාණං ආගම්ම රාගාදීෝ කීනාති ඒකමේව නිබ්බාණං රාගක්ඛයෝ දෝසක්ඛයෝ මෝහක්ඛයෝ ති උච්චති. But what do we find in the joyous utterances of the Theras and Theris? Where do we realize Nibbana? As recorded in such texts as Thera and Theri Gata, they would say, Siti Bhutos Minibhutu, I am grown cool, extinguished as I am. The words Siti Bhuta and Nibbuta had a cooling effect even to the listener, though later scholars found them inadequate. Extinction is something that occurs within an individual and it brings with it the unique appeasement. As the Ratana Sutta says, Laddha Mudha Nibbutin Bhunjamana. They experience the bliss of appeasement won free of charge. Normally, appeasement is won at a cost, but here we have an appeasement that comes gratis. From the worldly point of view, extinction means annihilation. It has connotations of a precipice that is much dreaded. That is why the commentators conceived of it as something out there, on reaching which the defilements are abandoned. Nibbanam agam raga deokinati. Sometimes they would say that it is on seeing Nibbana that craving is destroyed. There seems to be some contradiction in the commentarial definition of Nibbana. On the one hand, we have the definition of Nibbana as the exit from craving, which is called a weaving. And on the other, it is said that it is on seeing Nibbana that craving is destroyed. To project Nibbana into a distance and to hope that craving will be destroyed only on seeing it is something like trying to build a staircase to a palace one cannot yet see. In fact, this is a simile which the Buddha had used in his criticism of the Brahmin's point of view. In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, we have a very clear statement of the third noble truth. Having first said that the second noble truth is craving, the Buddha goes on to define the third noble truth in these words. Tassāyeva tanhāya asesa virāga nirodho chāgo patinisāgo mutti anālayo. This is to say that the third noble truth is the complete fading away, cessation, giving up, relinquishment of that very craving, that it is the release from and non-attachment to that very craving. In other words, it is the destruction of this very mass of suffering which is just before us. In the suttas, the term tanhakkhayo, the destruction of craving, is very often used as a term for Nibbana. But the commentator says that destruction alone is not Nibbana. Kayamattam na Nibbana. But the destruction of craving itself is called the highest bliss in the following verse of the Udana. Yancha kama sukhang loki, yanchidam diriyan sukhang, tannakkhaya sukhasete, kanang naghanti sodasin. Whatever bliss from sense desires there is in the world, whatever divine bliss there is, all these are not worth 1/16 of the bliss of the destruction of craving. Many of the verses found in the Udana are extremely deep. And this is understandable since Udana means a joyous utterance. Generally, a joyous utterance comes from the very depths of one's heart, like a sigh of relief. As a matter of fact, one often finds that the concluding verse goes far deeper in its implications than the narrative concern. For instance, in the Uddapana Sutta, we get the following joyous utterance coming from the Buddha himself. King Kaira Uddapanena Apache Sabbadasyum Tanhaya Mulato Chetva Kissa Pariyasanam Chare. What is the use of a well if water is there all the time, having cut craving at it at the root, in search of what should one wander? This shows that the destruction of craving is not a mere destruction. Craving is a form of thirst, and that is why Nibbana is sometimes called pipasa vinayo, the dispelling of the thirst. To think that the destruction of craving is not sufficient is like trying to give water to one who has already quenched his thirst. But the destruction of craving has been called the highest bliss. One who has quenched his thirst for good is aware of that blissful experience When he sees the world running here and there in search of water, he looks within and sees the wellspring of his bliss. However, to most of our scholars, the term Tanhakaya appeared totally negative, and that is why they hesitated to recognize its value. In such conventional usages as Nibbanam Agama, they found a grammatical excuse to separate that term from Nibbana. According to the Buddha, the cessation of existence is Nibbana, and that means Nibbana is the realization of the cessation of existence. Existence is said to be an 11-fold fire. So the entire existence is a raging fire. Lust, hate, delusion, all these are fires. Therefore, Nibbana may be best rendered by the word extinction. When once the fires are extinguished, what more is needed? But unfortunately, Venerable Buddha was not prepared to appreciate this point of view. In his Visuddhimagga, as well as in the commentaries Sarathappakasini and Sammohavinodini, he gives a long discussion on Nibbana in the form of an argument with an imaginary heretic. Some of his arguments are not in keeping with either the letter or the spirit of the Dhamma. First of all, he gets the heretic to put forward the idea that the destruction of lust, hate and delusion is Nibbana. Actually, the heretic is simply quoting the Buddha word. For in the Nibbana Sutta, Asankhata Samyutta, the destruction of lust, hate and delusion is called Nibbana. Rāgakhyo, dosakhyo, mohakhyo, idam ucchati Nibbana. The words rāgakhyo, dosakhyo and mohakhyo together form a synonym of Nibbana. But the commentator interprets it as three synonyms. Then he argues out with the imaginary heretic that if Nibbana is the extinguishing of lust, it is something common even to the animals, for they also extinguish their fires of lust through enjoyment of the corresponding objects of sense. This argument ignores the deeper sense of the word extinction, as it is found in the Dhamma. In the Margandhya Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha gives the simile of a man with a skin disease sitting beside a pit of hot embers to explain the position of lustful beings in the world. That man is simply trying to assuage his pains by the heat of the fire. It is an attempt to warm up, not to cool down. Similarly, what the lustful beings in the world are doing in the face of the fire of lust is a warming up. It can in no way be compared to the extinction and the cooling down of the arahants. As the phrase Nibbutin Bhunjamana implies, that extinction is a blissful experience for the arahants. It leaves a permanent effect on the arahant, so much so that upon reflection he sees that his influxes are extinct, just as a man with his hands and feet cut off knows upon reflection that his limbs are gone. It seems that the deeper implications of the word Nibbana have been obscured by a set of arguments which are rather than misleading. In fact, I came forward to give these sermons for three reasons. Firstly, because the Venerable Great Preceptor invited me to do so. Secondly, in the hope that it will be of some benefit to my court dwellers in the Dhamma. And thirdly, because I myself felt rather concerned about the inadequacy of the existing interpretations. What we have said so far is just about the word Nibbana as such. Quite a number of suttas on Nibbana will be taken up for discussion. This is just a preamble to show that the word Nibbana in the sense of extinction has a deeper dimension, which has some relevance to the law of dependent arising, particular of path. By bringing in an etymology based on the element vana, much of the original significance of the word Nibbana came to be undermined. On quite a number of occasions, the Buddha has declared that the cessation of suffering is Nibbana, or else that the destruction of craving is Nibbana. Terms like dukkha nirodho, and Tanakhil have been used as synonyms. If they are synonyms, there is no need to make any discrimination with regard to some of them by insisting on a periphrastic usage like agam. Yet another important aspect of the problem is the relation of Nibbana to the holy life or brahmacharya. It is said that when the holy life is lived out to the full, it culminates in Nibbana. In the Radha Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, we find the Venerable Radha putting a series of questions to the Buddha to get an explanation. First of all, he asked, Sammadasanam panabhante kimathyam? For what purpose is right vision? And the Buddha gives the answer, Sammadasanam ko radha nibbidattam. Radha, right vision is for purposes of disgust or dejection, and that is to say disgust for samsara. The next question is, for what purpose is disgust? The Buddha answers, disgust is for dispassion. What is the purpose of dispassion? The purpose of dispassion is release. What is the purpose of release? The purpose of release is Nibbana. Last of all, Venerable Radha puts the question, Nibbana panabhante kimathyam? For what purpose is Nibbana? And the Buddha gives this answer, Acca sararadha panya nasakhi panyasa paryantam gahetam Nibbana ugadhani radha brahmacharyam gusati Nibbana parayanam Nibbana pariyosanam. Radha, you have gone beyond the scope of your questions. You are unable to grasp the limit of your questions. For Radha, the holy life is merged in Nibbana. Its consummation is Nibbana. Its culmination is Nibbana. This shows that the holy life gets merged in Nibbana, just as rivers get merged in the sea. In other words, where the holy life is lived out to the full, Nibbana is right there. That is why Venerable Nanda, who earnestly took up the holy life encouraged by the Buddha's promise of heavenly nymphs, attained Ananthood almost in spite of himself. At last, he approached the Buddha and begged to relieve him of the onus of his promise. This shows that when one completes the training in the holy life, one is already in Nibbana. Only when the training is incomplete can one go to heaven. Here then is a result which comes of its own accord. So there is no justification for a periphrastic usage like on reaching Nibbana. No glimpse of a distant object is necessary. At whatever moment the Noble Eightfold Path is perfected, one attains Nibbana then and there. Now, in the case of an examination, after answering the question paper, one has to wait for the results to get a pass. Here it is different. As soon as you have answered the paper correctly, you have passed immediately and the certificate is already there. This is the significance of the term Anya used in such context. Anya stands for full certitude of the experience of Nibbana. The experience of the fruit of arahantship gives him the final certificate of his attainment, Anya Phala. That is why Nibbana is called something to be realized. One gets the certitude that birth is extinct and that the holy life is lived out to the full. Kina jati usitam brahmacharya. Of course, there are some who still go on asking, what is the purpose of Nibbana? And it is to answer this type of question that many scholars go on hair splitting. Normally in the world, whatever one does has some purpose or other. All occupations, all trades and businesses are for gain and profit. Thieves and burglars also have some purpose in mind. But what is the purpose of trying to attain Nibbana? What is the purpose of Nibbana? Why should one attain Nibbana? It is to give an answer to this question that scholars brought in such phrases as Nibbana Panagama, on reaching Nibbana. They would say that on reaching Nibbana, craving would be destroyed. On closer analysis, it would appear that there is some fallacy in this question. For if there is any aim or purpose in attaining Nibbana, Nibbana would not be the ultimate aim. In other words, if Nibbana is the ultimate aim, there should be no aim in attaining Nibbana. Though it may well sound a tautology, one has to say that Nibbana is the ultimate aim for the simple reason that there is no aim beyond it. However, this might need more explanation. Now, as far as craving is concerned, it has the nature of projection or inclination. It is something bent forward with a forward view, and that is why it is called bhavanetti, the leader in becoming. It leads one on and on in existence, like the cat before the donkey. So that is why all objects presented by craving have some object or purpose as a projection. Craving is an inclination. But what is the position? If one makes the destruction of craving itself one's object. Now craving, because of its inclining nature, is always bent forward. So much so that we get an infinite progression. This is for that, and that is for the other. As the phrase tanha pono bhavika implies, craving brings up existence again and again. But this is not the case when one makes the destruction of craving one's aim. When that aim is attained, there is nothing more to be done. So this brings us to the conclusion that the term tanha kyo, destruction of craving, is a full-fledged synonym of Nibbana. Well, this much is enough for today. Time permitting and life permitting, I hope to continue with these sermons. I suppose the Most Venerable Great Preceptor made this invitation with the idea of seeing one of his children at play. For good or for bad, I have taken up the invitation. Let the future of the sasana be the final judge of its merits.
Dear listeners, it is our sincere wish to make these sermons accessible, free of charge, to all who like to listen to them, because the gift of the Dhamma excels all other gifts. We therefore encourage you to copy these sermons and share them with others, but kindly note that they should not be reproduced for sale. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you.